Hello and welcome back to another episode of the HRER podcast, where we delve into the world of HR emergencies and scandals. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to HRER on your favourite podcast platform.
Get ready for scandalous stories, lessons learned, and a generous dose of advice for HR professionals for navigating the HR landscape.
Our goal here is not just to entertain, but also to help you learn from the topics we touch on in order to save your business from its own emergency. We're going to talk about employment myths, and I think it should be called employment mythbusters.
Basically, it's about what employers need to know. How expensive an argument can get when something isn't written down can't be overstated. People can argue for years about verbal contracts because we don't even know what our starting point is. The employee, their little myth is, but I didn't sign it. I didn't sign the contract, therefore I can do what I want. No, you can't. Just before we start, protect your business from the risk of tribunal, reduce legal costs, and save yourself from HR headaches with our Hero software and employment law consultancy services.
We've got a bit of a different structure today, haven't we, compared to normal ones. This is the result of you not being in the initial meeting and me and Dawn going off on a tangent.
Let's do it.
We're going to talk about employment myths, and I think it should be called employment mythbusters.
Okay, but basically it's about what employers need to know. Yeah. So on our socials, week in, week out, Dawn asks us for an employment myth, and it's to go out in our newsletter, it goes out on socials, and these sort of pop up every now and again when employers will come and say, oh, I think I can or I can't do this. And it's, they're urban myths, a lot of them, or things that Google have told them, or even AI at the moment, is kind of peddling these myths. So we've picked some of the most common ones, I would say, to go through today.
Yeah, I mean, some of these as well, like, come up in, I've thought of them as well, like in the past, but we'll cover that as we go. So first
I know
one.
Where we got it from. It's from when we did the reveal on the podcast that the employment record wasn't a thing, and you were astonished. And you were like, yeah. What do you mean the record doesn't follow me everywhere I go?
There's not a piece of paper?
It's like
that
employers just covertly share between themselves, like, here's his file. No, it doesn't work like that. The employment record's a myth.
Yeah.
Unless you're in a regulated sector, that's different. But generally, you know, I'm not keeping a file thinking, right, when Holly and Dawn move on, this is what I'm going to tell the next employer and give them all this stuff. No, it doesn't happen.
We'll crack on with first one. So, no contract for employees, no liability. Is it true that if an employee doesn't have a written contract, the employer has no liability?
No, so that's utter rubbish. And this is something that, particularly when we take on new consultancy clients, so people who we're working with to advise them day to day, where I will say, right, can we see your contracts so that we can review them? And they go, oh, no, we don't have any. They're like, because, you know, we don't want to be like tied down to anything. So it means that we can kind of manage the employees how we want. It gives us more flexibility and there's no liability, because what they think is no contract. I can't be sued on a particular clause of the contract. And I'm very much like, this is probably one of the most common myths, particularly with either small businesses or new business owners, whether, you know, say a startup, they're doing this for the first time, is even if you don't have a written contract of employment, the law implies various terms between the employer and the employee relationship. So whether we like it or not, there is a standard set of terms that is implied into that relationship. The key one being trust and confidence. So if we do something that breaches the trust and confidence between an employer and employee, it gives an employee a legal claim. We've also then got statutory sick pay. That is a statutory right. We've got holiday pay, which is a statutory right. So there's various things in our legislation that are there whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I must confess, I knew a little bit about this because I've had a job in the past where I had like a verbal contract, like agreed on, like wage, obviously, and certain things like that.
Yeah.
So that was like a teaching role.
So verbal, I mean, you did this with your fingers.
I did do that.
Verbal contracts are a thing.
Yeah.
You know, verbal contracts are still contracts, but verbal contracts are dangerous because if something's not written down, it's like, well, you said this. Well, no, you didn't. You said this. Oh, yes, but I thought you meant this. And how expensive an argument can get when something isn't written down can't be overstated. People can argue for years about verbal contracts because we don't even know what our starting point is. Whereas with a written contract, well, at least we've got the words on the page. We know where we're starting from.
References, and you can reference certain things.
Precisely. And, So my view on these, and probably the view of every employment lawyer or advisor in the UK, would be it's incredibly dangerous to rely on verbal terms. Because one, you're working from statutory entitlements, which you might not be sure of what they are. So mm-hmm. the number of times I get an employer who'll say, I need to dismiss this person, but we don't have a contract. I don't even know how much notice I've got to give them. They don't know how to end that relationship.
So what are they asking you for advice for if they don't know?
Because then the statutory notice comes into play.
Okay.
So that's where when someone starts work, if they're not given a contract, within the first 2 years of employment, the employer has to give 1 week's notice.
Okay.
After those first 2 years, the employee gets an extra week's notice for every year they work for the employer. So they work there for 3 years, they get 3 weeks' notice. They work there for 6 years, they get 6 weeks' notice. And it's capped at 12. What happens in those situations is the law steps in and puts these terms in place, which might not be convenient for your business. So an employee only has to give a week's notice by statute.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a key employee who, if they leave and give a week's notice, a week, 5 working days, for you to either replace that person or get your head around the fact that they are leaving... Someone senior, you might want them on 6 months' notice.
I've seen that with like higher managers before, yeah.
Exactly. So if you're putting yourselves into the hand of the statutory safety net, mm-hmm. it's not a good place to start from. And it doesn't mean that there's nothing that an employee can sue you for. What it basically means is we haven't set out the rules of the game. And this is the way I compare it to is like a board game. So if you sat down and you tried to play Monopoly with 5 other people and none of you have read the rule book... How is that game going to go? It's going to be chaos.
It is.
It's going to be total chaos. It's like some will go around the board this way. Some are going to go around the board the other way. I'm just going to take some money from the bank because I don't know what the rules are.
I'm robbing.
Actually, it sounds like playing Monopoly with my family anyway. However, that's the way I describe it. An employment relationship without a contract is like trying to play Monopoly without having read the rules first.
Do you sort of like shake your head then when people are on the phone and they're like, oh, we ain't got a contract?
Especially when they sound really triumphant about it. I'm like, right,
I think it's a good idea.
So I'm going to break your heart. Like, I really am, because it's not a good idea. And it doesn't mean the employee has no rights. Employees have lots of rights because the law puts them there. And there's loads of little quirks that, again, if we aren't putting things into a written contract and we are at the mercy of what the statute says... that we're running our business according to the way that Parliament wrote the laws in 1996.
Is that how far back the...
At the moment, until the Employment Rights Bill comes in, which will be later this year, early next.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the basis of the law that we're working with.
Christ.
With if we don't put a contract in place. So it's crucial that we write down what the rules of the game are. This is how we are all going to work together. This is what we expect from you. This is what you can expect from us. Because it might be you've got an employee whose expectations are wholly unrealistic about the working relationship. And when you say, well, no, we don't do things like that here, they go, well, I don't have a contract.
I don't know.
How am I supposed to know?
It's shirking responsibility, isn't it? In your experience, is the lack of contract down to just laziness? Or
I don't think I'd call anyone lazy with it.
Inexperience, perhaps?
Inexperience and probably naivety.
Okay.
And also not recognising the importance of this document. So people will think, rightly so, when someone gets started, I need to put them to work.
Yeah, yeah.
I need to send their information to payroll. I need to get them bedded in. And often it's that I was going to do it at some point.
Oh, I'll push it to the back.
They've got good intentions, yeah. But all they see it as is another piece of admin, and it is not. There is a legal requirement to give what we call a Section 1 statement of terms on or before the first day of employment. So a Section 1 statement of terms doesn't have to be a formal contract, but there is a list of mandated information that we have to provide to an employee before they start work. That could literally be in a letter that says, Dear Joe Bloggs, this is your Section 1 statement of terms. They are. Our company name is this. The place you will work from is here. This is your line manager. This is your pay. You get this many holidays. This is what you get if you're off sick. This is how much pension will pay for you. There are no collective agreements and we're not part of a trade union. There is a specific list of things that you have to provide and you go, kind regards, your employer. That is enough to be a Section 1 statement.
Okay.
So as long as you've done that, you're compliant and then you can follow up with your formal contract afterwards. But actually, why duplicate the work?
You might as well do it all in one, haven't you?
Just provide the contract on or before day one.
It's not a hard thing to do. Is I can get AI to drum you one up, can't you, nowadays?
Or... the hero software, Ollie. AI. No, we don't want AI building contracts for us.
No, we don't. You're right.
If Dom was sat closer to you, you should be smacking you around the back of the head.
This, haven't we? We spoke about this before. Yeah. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, of course you are. You were handing me a plug there, weren't you? That's what you were doing. Giving me the opportunity to say
worry about
the
that.
Software builds it. So yes, our software will generate contracts. We generate big contracts, which are many, many pages long that people go, oh God, there's so much paperwork. We also generate a nice little two-pager. It contains the bare essentials of what you need to be legally compliant. And there it is, it goes off to the employee. The other myth, and this is kind of a little mini myth that comes off it, is, and this is one that I always heard in my employee representative days. I know, don't stop watching because I used to represent employees. I'm sorry, I won't do it again. But with employers, as long as they have issued the terms to the employee, we are compliant. We have given it to the staff member. They have it. We're good. The employee, their little myth is, but I didn't sign it. I didn't sign the contract, therefore I can do what I want. No, you can't.
But.
No, you can't.
Oh, you can't.
No, you can't. If you continue to work for your employer after they have given you a contract, you've agreed to the terms.
By simply turning up?
By turning up to work. You've accepted the terms. Right. The tribunal is very, very comfortable with that as a concept. If an employee doesn't agree to the terms of their contract, they are expected to leave. You don't continue to work under those terms. So that's the other little myth, is employers then tie themselves in knots over it. And I've seen them not go through the issuing the whole contract exercise because they can't be bothered with chasing down 300 people for signatures. You don't have to. Send them. You're done with it. Be done with it. And again, our system does allow you to sign them. So
you get notified.
You get notified and all that stuff. Yeah, it's all in there. It's all good. It all gets stored. It's all very organized. And we've made it so easy. So there's no reason not to do it. However, that's kind of myth busting the other side of it is just because you think you're going to be chasing employees forever to get them back. Don't worry about it.
No. Can someone really work for a few days without a contract or right to work check? What risks do employers take on here?
No, they cannot. So this is something I get asked, particularly in the lead up to the summer holidays. All the time. This is the time of year people are taking on their temporary and their seasonal staff members, or where they're getting people in for, you know, saying, oh, we're going to give this chef a trial for a week and see how he gets on. And they're moving through the staff quite quickly to see, you know, trying to find their staff base for the summer, particularly where I live. And I keep getting asked, I've run out of fingers for the number of times I've been asked this over the last 2 or 3 weeks, is, oh, but they're only going to work for us for 6 weeks. So, no, you still have to issue a contract. We still have to do right to work checks. If we employ somebody who doesn't legally have the right to work in this country, if they work for us for a day, we have broken the law.
Liable for?
Well, it's criminal sanctions and there's enormous fines. And it's not going to work in our favour to say, oh, but Judge, I only let them work for me for 3 weeks. You broke the law the minute that they came in and were undertaking paid work because they don't have the right to work.
I like to ask how much, don't I?
Employing individuals without the right to work, up to £45,000 for the first breach and up to £60,000 for repeated breaches per illegal worker. So you can be looking at hundreds of thousands of pounds.
That can soon add up, can't it?
With just a handful of workers. So super, super high risk. We always, 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 always do the right to work check. It can be done in seconds. Particularly through an automated system like ours.
We integrate with
Trust ID. So super, super easy to do. There is no excuse for not doing it, particularly because there is no cost to the employer for doing it through our system. That is all wrapped up into the cost of our service. So it's not even like there's any administrative or cost burden for doing it. However, it could save you 45 grand if you're caught on
it's
the wrong
good.
Side of this.
We did it, didn't we? I did it.
Yeah.
Very good.
And then when we think about the contract situation, remember the obligation is on or before the first day of employment. So if someone works for us for a day, we have to give them a Section 1 statement of terms. If it's just someone coming in on a trial few days, trials is kind of the other side of this myth.
It's
they're still
word.
Working and they're being paid. No, they are working. So even if it's only a temporary assignment while you decide whether you give them permanent terms or a fixed term contract, we still need to give them a Section 1 statement of terms. Even if it means that we give them a second one if the trial is successful and then we update them. Mm-hmm. So there's a client that I work with where we do this fairly regularly. For those that are coming in on trial shifts, we have a Section 1 statement of terms to say, essentially, it's a fixed term position for a week. Whilst we work out whether or not you are eligible for a longer-term contract with us, they have all the relevant information for the Section 1 statement. We do the right to work check. If they pass the week, they're then issued with a full contract, either on a permanent or a longer fixed-term basis. And With Employment Rights Bill coming, people are going to have the right not to be unfairly dismissed from day one of employment. So not only is it important that we've got the contract and the right to work checks, we need to make sure that we are doing the basics, because much more serious compliance burdens are coming down the line. We know it's coming. We've seen now the timelines for all this stuff to become real life. You know, businesses, they need to help themselves by getting that preparation done and making this part of their everyday operation. Otherwise, there's serious, serious risk to them from legal liability going forward.
Gonna lose some monies, aren't you?
Yeah.
Gonna lose some monies.
Yeah. I mean, great for us, because, you know, we advise employers, so when things go wrong, but I don't know whether to take offence to this. It's when, like, I speak to clients and they go, I hope I don't speak to you soon. And I'm like, thanks, I love talking to all of you.
It's not personal, this, honestly.
Feels very personal. But then equally, people tend to only ring me when things are going wrong, which is the wrong way to use a legal advisor, by the way. You should be using a legal advisor to be talking about either potential risk, or if you're planning things with your workforce, or you're thinking about change, or there's something that doesn't quite feel right, there's something niggling, mm-hmm. Pick the phone up and go, what do you make of this situation?
You need to get ahead.
Firefighting's messy. You know, before someone kind of leaves the stove on and burns the house down, let's talk about it at that point rather than when we're sweeping ashes up off the drive.
Let's talk about the smell of gas before the fire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Is that a good metaphor?
I'll run with that.
You're like, your face was like, no, and then you're like, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, you can have that one. I'll let you have that one. I think we've busted that myth, haven't we?
Myth busted. Ready for the second one?
Yeah, let's
go straight into it.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a shorter one. You can dismiss in probation without consequence.
No.
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 There is consequences.
Myth busted. I'm joking.
Let's go on the next one.
So,
what are the consequences?
At the moment, people get the right not to be unfairly dismissed after 2 years. What that has led to is this myth that when someone is in a probation or they have been employed for less than 2 years, that you can dismiss someone without consequence. However, if someone is dismissed for something that is discriminatory, or because they have blown the whistle, or because they've raised health and safety concerns, if they are then dismissed or put to some negative treatment as a result which causes them to resign, they can claim unfair dismissal. And actually, it can be automatic unfair dismissal in some cases. I'll come on to that in a moment. Now, that all sounds very serious, like, oh, well, it's unlikely that I'll have someone who makes, you know, a health and safety disclosure while they're with us. That all sounds very formal. It could literally be an employee who's like, oh, mate, that's not great what's going on over there. It doesn't have to be a written formal health and this is a formal health and safety disclosure. I am blowing the whistle.
It can just be a passing
comment.
If
someone raises a concern that is legitimate, where there is a public interest and it's on the grounds of health and safety, where there's criminal conduct, or they think that there's laws being broken around environmental points, that is potentially enough to be a whistleblow or a protected disclosure.
Right, okay.
When someone rings me and says, this person's only been here 3 months, I want to dismiss them. And I say, right, are there any protected characteristics? Have we had any whistleblow, any grievance? And they go, no. And I'm like, have there been any niggles? Anything? Have they said anything that is concerning them at all about the workplace, even in a passing comment? And I go down to that level of detail before I then give the advice to say, in principle, it's a lower risk dismissal. However, if you have got someone at the top of the chain who, from line manager feedback, has been asked to dismiss someone, if the line manager is aware of stuff and feels this person's a troublemaker, I want this person out, has enough investigation gone on at the top of the tree? And we've had case law around this about what was in the mind of the dismissing officer at the time of dismissal. Some companies have kind of scraped through, some haven't. So it's really, really important, and particularly from a cultural perspective and to stop bad line management behavior, that if you're someone who is at the top of the tree, say you're in HR and you've just been asked to go through a process, that you understand why. Why is this line manager not happy with this individual? What has actually been going on the ground? Because there could be a whole bubble of liability that we're not aware of. But if we're just blindly following instructions, that at some point that bubble's going to burst.
A few things you said there about the line manager and like trusting them makes me think of like, you might find like bias in these situations.
Yeah. Particularly like where someone's being recruited by one person and then put in the department of somebody else and they feel the face doesn't fit.
Okay.
You can often see that. And that's where you can sometimes get that underlying discrimination.
Okay.
So it might not be immediately obvious, but what I always say is we don't want to rely on that 2-year rule like it's gospel, particularly because of what's coming down the road with the Employment Rights Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have got what people are starting to call the statutory probation period, which is going to come in under the Employment Rights Bill.
Okay.
where what we expect is that the burden of dismissal will be slightly lower. So at the moment, if someone's been there 2 years, we have to go through a full process. We have to have a fair reason for dismissal, and we've got the various procedural requirements that we have to meet. What we're expecting, but we don't know yet, is that those may be watered down slightly during the probation period, and that there will still be acceptable fair reasons for dismissal. But it is certainly not going to be as easy as calling someone into the office and saying, sorry, mate, it's not working out. HP 45 and off you go, which is what some people unfortunately do at the moment.
I've heard of recent experiences of one of my friends has had that.
Yeah.
Quite a shocking.
And you're dealing with human beings. These are people with mortgages, lives. They're relying on their income. How many people these days could confidently say, if I lost my job tomorrow,
I'm covered,
that I'm totally fine?
Yeah, not many.
You know, there's probably not that many.
We're in an economic crisis. You won't know.
You sound very confident. What economic crisis?
I'm all right. I gauge it on whether I look at the price of things in the supermarket. Yeah. And I never have done, really. I'm not saying, like, I've got loads of money.
Am I paying you too much, Ollie?
No.
That sounds like it. No, that is also the point that I constantly come back to is we are dealing with people. These are not just numbers on a page. That we should be dealing with these things with emotional intelligence, with psychological safety, respecting the fact that people have lives outside of work and they are dependent on their work. That doesn't mean that we keep someone who is wrong for a role there for longer than they should be, but it also means that we should have the decency to, at the very least, go through an element of process with people before we just make the decision to get rid of them.
Fair, innit? At the very least, be fair.
But the point I wanted to come back to on the automatic unfair dismissal. Yes. So this is a techie point. So
techie.
I'm going to watch your face and make sure you're still with me, because you're my barometer for how well this will be how well this will be received.
Right.
So
hit me.
When we go through a process and we are thinking about an unfair dismissal claim, so someone who's dismissed after 2 years who says their dismissal was unfair, they will be wanting to prove to a tribunal that the process that they were taken through and the decisions that were made were unfair.
Yes.
So I was dismissed for an unfair reason, and this is why I think it was unfair. With automatic unfair dismissal, the employee doesn't have that burden.
Okay.
If the judge finds they were dismissed for that reason, it is automatically unfair. We don't need to worry about the fair procedure.
Okay.
So actually, if we're dismissing people for these high-risk reasons, it is cutting out so much legal red tape for that employee. It makes their case very, very easy.
They don't have to get involved, really, from what you're saying.
All they have to prove is they were dismissed for that reason, essentially, in a stripped-back version of how they'd prepare for that claim.
Okay.
Is if they prove I was dismissed for blowing the whistle, that dismissal is automatically unfair, even if a fair procedure was followed.
Whereas, like, correct me if I'm wrong, like, currently do they have to, like, go and give evidence and stuff?
So if they were dismissed for, say, something that was conduct-related, okay. So, you know, employees punch someone else in the face.
Okay.
And they're dismissed for that.
Yes.
Employer still has to go through the fair process. They have to dismiss them for something that's conduct related. They have to have a fair and reasonable belief that they have done something wrong. They have to invite them to a meeting, give the evidence in advance, hold the meeting, give them the outcome, explain the reasons for dismissal, provide the right of appeal. And an employee can go at that case from two angles. They can say, the procedure was fine, it was fair, but actually your decision was unfair. You shouldn't have dismissed me for that. It was too severe. Or the employee could say, your process was unfair. Had you followed a fair process, I wouldn't have been dismissed. So then the employee and the employer are arguing over whether the decision was reasonable, was it enough to dismiss, you know, should I have done this, should we have done that, what could we have done to make this process more fair, did I have a reasonable belief in what was going on? Whereas with automatic unfair dismissal, we're not arguing about that stuff, it's were you dismissed for that reason? If you were dismissed for that protected reason, your dismissal is unfair. It's a much, much simpler claim for an employee. So not only does it get the employee around the two-year rule, it also makes it much, much easier to run.
Nice.
Your facial barometer is not giving me much confidence, but we'll see how this lands.
No, I got it. Yeah. I think I got it. It works more in favour of the employee, obviously. It's like a hands-free sort of...
Basically, yeah.
So I have got it.
Yeah. Yeah. You look very pleased with yourself.
Okay. I think we've got time for one more, eh?
Yeah, I reckon so.
I quite like this one. Restrictive covenants are always enforceable.
No.
No.
No, they're not. So if a restrictive covenant goes beyond what is reasonably necessary to protect the employer's legitimate interests,
mm-hmm.
So if we restrict someone for 5 years from working anywhere in the UK within this entire sector, probably going beyond what's reasonably required.
Mm-hmm.
There's very, very few exceptions of businesses that have these exceptional interests that mean that we are restricting someone for long periods. Typically, anything over a year, you're really, really going to have to try and justify it.
There was one of my old contracts, and I researched it, and I found that is it true that like most judges find them quite distasteful?
There's definitely an attitude shift.
Okay.
So we're going to be seeing changes again under the Employment Rights Bill around restrictive covenants potentially. But ultimately, my starting point with these is, what are you trying to achieve? Is it that this person has loads of trade secrets that we are worried they're going to go and carry off to someone else? I don't think restrictive covenants are actually the best way necessarily of dealing with that.
No,
People try and breach them all the time. You've then got to get an emergency injunction. They cost a fortune. If the judge doesn't find in your favor, you're paying costs on that and the employee can run off and go and do what they want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you have someone who is super valuable and they have lots of trade secrets, they should be on a long notice period and you should have a garden leave clause so that you can take that person out of the business, you can isolate them from your company information, you can cut them off from the systems, and they sit at home for several months letting their knowledge go out of date before they go on to the new employer.
Okay.
You can restrict their activities because they remain your employee. If they go and work for somebody else, it's likely, provided your contract has been given to them and the term is in there, that they will be in breach of contract if they're working for someone else whilst they remain under contract with you. That is a much more effective way. Employers don't like it because they're paying someone to do nothing for several months. But the way I phrase it is, you're not paying them to do nothing. You're paying to protect your information.
That's a good way
and it's a pragmatic way of doing it that you know is going to be more enforceable. Now, restrictive covenants used to be that if the judge found that part of it was unenforceable, the whole thing would fail. Okay. Now, they can do what's called blue penning, which is a legal term, which is where the judge will sit down and go, well, I don't like this bit, but we will amend it to what we think is more reasonable.
Okay.
That does kind of work in the favor of the employer, but this is a really expensive exercise. I don't particularly like emergency injunctions or doing injunctive relief because it costs a fortune. There's no guarantee it's that quick. And the reality is, if you're injuncting an employee for doing something or trying to stop them from doing something again, the knowledge is probably already out the door.
How do you monitor that?
You can't get it back. Once they've told someone something, somebody else knows something. So my preference is much more around being proactive with your notice periods and swallowing the bitter pill of accepting that someone's going to be on a paid notice period for some time.
It just seems a little bit, especially where it's like a really big business.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's a, I don't know, even if they're like a middle manager, like it just, in my head, I'm coming from it from a point of an employee, obviously. It just seems a little bit like naff.
It's, you know, everyone should have the right to go out and be able to earn a living.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be able to earn a living off the back of, say, knowledge that someone else has built up and paid to develop. So say, for example, you've got a company who has invested a significant amount of money in developing a list of customers. You take that list of customers and you give it to your new employer.
Okay.
That's property that's been paid for, yes, that someone's, you know, blood, sweat and tears potentially has gone into producing. I can understand about protecting that. But if it's just that, you know, we don't want them working for a competitor, but actually if their knowledge isn't that brilliant, or we don't think actually they'd represent much of a risk, let them go.
That's like GDPR though, isn't it? If you're using like mail lists from other companies.
So, I mean, that is also a legal company. But what I'm saying, like, it's an example of, you know, stuff that we would want to protect.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you take our business, for example, we have spent years building up our knowledge of the market that we're operating in, what employers want, taking feedback on certain elements, and you know, that knowledge has taken years of work and investment to get to. If someone then walks into another business and gives that to someone else and they haven't had to work for it, then it feels unfair to the employer. Whereas if, say, you wanted to go and do system testing for another business and you can do so without telling people how we're doing everything, fine, you know? But the problem is when someone leaves, the trust in the relationship often starts to deteriorate. So it's what you've got is two sides that are very nervous about what the other might do, and which again erodes that relationship even more, it's why I'm a fan of the long notice period rather than getting into a legal fight over something, which as a lawyer, I should be advocating legal fights because they make lots of money. I am an advocate of the longer notice period because I just think it's so much more effective. And also, I don't like to burn bridges. You think in the future, when someone's gone off to another business, learnt loads of skills, you might want them back with all of those skills.
You never know where you might end up. Depends though, isn't it? It's very dependent. Myth busted. Restrictive covenants are not always enforceable. Is it true that they're not used in the US? I read that somewhere. America don't like them.
See, their stuff's done on a federal basis. Not federal, what's the word? Anyway, state by state, it's all different. Their employment law per state is different.
Okay.
So we've got clients, we've got two clients in New York.
That's really hard.
And one with some stuff going on in California. I don't touch California. California's a nightmare with labor laws.
Bad.
It's like, go and outsource that to someone in America. However, New York's relatively straightforward. I've got quite a lot of experience of dealing with New York labor laws. I worked at an international law firm before, so I'm quite happy with New York. But yeah, California, no thanks.
No, no.
Go and deal with an American lawyer. So it depends, state by state, it's different.
Okay. I'm going on things, I think I've read it ages ago, mate, to be honest. But yeah, myth busted.
We've got two more, so we could do these super quick.
Okay. Long-term sick employees can be dismissed automatically.
Nope, have to go through a capability process. So normal rules apply when it comes to, even if someone has admitted that they are too sick to ever work again, we can't just go, thank you very much for that, here's P45. We still need to go through that process of, do we have reasonable belief that this person is not capable for their role? We have the meeting with them, we do the welfare checks, we take occupational health opinions if we need to, and then we always, always, always dismiss with notice because this person hasn't done anything wrong. They get their notice if we're saying that they're not well enough. So it's not an automatic dismissal. We still have to go through a fair process, even if the end result seems inevitable where the employee has admitted that they're not able to work. It might be we don't need to go through that first written warning, final warning on attendance, and then ultimately dismiss. We may well be able to get to that final meeting quicker, but we still have to go through a fair process and engage and consult the employee.
Myth busted, last one. You can deduct money from an employee when they steal from the business.
This is a good one. No. If you haven't got in the contract the right to deduct money from an employee, you cannot just take it back.
It's a clause.
It's in your contract, darling. You should have read it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We have the right to deduct money from you in a various number of circumstances.
Okay.
Yeah, there's loads.
Oh, wow.
And I think ours actually says it's not exhaustive. So,
what's that mean?
That
it could be more.
We've written a list, but you know, if we think to add some, well, you're coughing up.
You hold the cards.
We hold the cards because we have a contract of employment.
Yes.
Back to the first one.
Yes.
So what I often get is in situations where you get, or some industries where there's lots of breakages, where people break stuff all the time or expensive machinery gets broken, they want to take money off the employee, particularly where an employee has been negligent. Oh, I had someone who threw a laptop across a room in a temper. They wanted him to pay for that.
That ain't negligent.
No, exactly. So in those situations where it's not like, okay, in the olden days when charge cables weren't magnetic, and someone would walk past a desk, trip over the cable, and the laptop falls off the desk.
I know the
It
ones.
Used to happen all the time. Yeah. You probably wouldn't deduct for that. Someone picks up a laptop and throws it across the room, I'm taking your wages for that one. However, unless you've got the right to deduct in that contract, you should not be doing it.
Okay.
The reality is, so say, for example, you've got employee theft and you deduct from the wages and you don't have the clause, it's unlikely the employee's going to fight that. But still, as a matter of best practice, we don't take money from employees unless we have specified in the contract that we have the right to do so.
I didn't know the right to deduct was a thing.
Yeah.
I learned something new on everyone.
How many times on these pods have I told you to read your contract, Ollie?
I think
many.
I think at least three.
Yeah.
I just thought then, like, you've said that a lot to me. Yeah. And I've been like, a few times. Myth busted. You can't deduct money from an employee when they steal from the business. Or you can. You can. Because
you can if it's in the contract. It has to be in the contract. So it's back to that first myth.
Myth busted.
Rules of the game.
Rules of the game. General questions to finish on. I'm just going to do the second one because I like that one more. No techie reason behind that. What role do HR and legal advisors play in clearing up these misconceptions in the workplace?
Absolutely crucial, because a lot of these myths are the reason why people end up in tribunal. Because people will proceed wholeheartedly believing some of these when actually they are wrong. And there's nothing more powerful than someone who absolutely believes that they are right and sets their principles by it, because they are the people who are not going to settle. They're going to go all the way. So if, as HR, legal advisors, lawyers, we can kind of get this out there that these myths aren't a thing, then hopefully it helps employers and employees to be a bit more measured about the way they behave.
Yeah, man. Some people don't know what they don't know. And on that, this week, I found out there's 52 weeks in a year.
How many weeks did you think were in a
51.
Year?
51. I've been saying that for my life.
Are you kidding me?
Nah.
I'm genuinely
deadly serious.
Who am I employing? Like,
I'm good at certain stuff, aren't I? I'm good at certain stuff.
Ollie!
Specific skill set.
Primary school children know that there's 52 weeks in a year.
I've forgotten.
How many days are in a week?
7.
How many months are in a year?
12.
There's some maths involved here that leads you to 52.
is there? What is the maths?
Oh, my days.
30 times. No, I don't know. I'm not good at maths.
How many days are there in a year?
365.
Okay.
And then what do I do with that? Sorry.
Best episode ever.
That were good though. That were all right.
Instead of trolling you about your hair, your beard, your clothes, please can people troll Ollie about his maths and his basic understanding of how our calendar works. Amazing.
I'm being deadly serious as well. I didn't know. I got corrected this week on that, and it just goes to show what you say with utter belief, people will believe.
So if I took a week's holiday off you from your entitlement, you'd be none the wiser. Because there's only 51 weeks in the year. Extra week you could have been on holiday.
Have at it. I wouldn't know. But yeah, that was good fun. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Hopefully everyone's learned a little bit of something from this episode.
I certainly have. 52 weeks. Like, comment, subscribe. Cheers. Until next time, we're your hosts signing off from HRER. Take care of your HR and may your workplace be disaster-free. Before we go, a big thank you to you for tuning in and don't forget to subscribe. If you have your own ER stories or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us at Heroes or on social media or even HRER@heroes.co.uk. As we navigate the maze of workplace blunders, remember that no organisation is perfect. But by sharing these stories, we can all work towards creating healthier, happier and more productive workplaces.